Rosalie Miller. Rosalie's still having abdominal problems and having dizziness and lightheadedness. So please pray for God to help her to have a speedy recovery. Thanks on behalf of Rosalie Miller. So pray that she would get better and be able to be back with us. As we begin the sermon, we have a picture that depicts God's creation. And we know that God formed man of the dust of the ground. And he breathed into his nostrils the breath of life, and man became a living being. So the first man was created from the dust of the ground. We know that the woman was created from Adam's rib, and God created and created them, and he formed them. And that's the thing that we always need to keep in mind. We exist because God created us, and God gave us life. And then as we continued on, God created us in his very image. You know, he placed Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden, and he created us in his image. So we are created in the form and shape of God, and we are the pinnacle of God's creation. And we are a special creation. You have animals and insects and fish and plants and all of that. Those are all wonderful things, but none of them is like a human being. We are created in the image of God. You know, as you think about the creation of a human being, it is an amazing thing that from a little sperm cell and an ovum, and they join together and they begin to split, as we see here. This splitting takes place, and eventually something begins to develop that is quite unique and wonderful. So from these two cells joining together, life begins. And God is the one who imparts life. And there is no life apart from God, but it is a miraculous thing that life can begin. You know, Lisa's pregnant, and down in Prestonsburg, Samantha Keithley is pregnant, so it's a wonderful thing to see a new life coming about, and it is a very special thing to God. So as that baby develops in the womb, it's a miraculous thing. We're able to look at what it's like in there, to look inside the mother's womb and see that baby developing, and it is a truly amazing thing. And here's this baby, you know, sucking its thumb, and even in the womb, some kids get an early start, but it is an amazing and miraculous thing as that baby is developed from these two cells and divided and formed and shaped, and there is a definite pattern that God works out here as the baby develops and progresses in the womb. And, you know, as this takes place, you know, the mother's belly begins to stick out there, and you can very clearly tell that the mother is pregnant, and that life is taking form and shape in the womb. And it is a beautiful and wonderful thing which we can all enjoy as human beings. And eventually you have a baby, and a life begins, and that child is a potential member of the family of God. That's why it is so special to God that a child is special to him, because they are all potential members of his family. And for you to terminate a life early with an abortion, you are ending, you know, the physical life of one who is a potential member of God's family. And so God is probably against abortion more than anyone, but even human actions that cause the life to be terminated aren't going to stop God's plan, because ultimately those children will have their opportunity to be a part of God's family. For all of us as members of the church, we understand the mystery of God and what God is working out here. And as our children are born and that time of the year comes, the Sabbath after the feast, we have the blessing of little children. And as the blessing of little children takes place, we want that blessing upon our kids, because we live in an evil, dangerous world, and we want our children to grow up to adulthood. We want God to watch over them. We want them to be able to enjoy a full life in the flesh and reap eternal life when all is said and done, as their life comes to an end. But the question that we have to ask ourselves is, as a child is born, will that child be a well-rounded adult? Will that child grow up to be a well-rounded adult? Will a child be able to enter into a healthy relationship with God and his fellow man? And how did God ensure that this would happen, that these things would happen? How did God ensure that? Well, God gave children parents. That is the way that God ensures, or meant to ensure, that a child would be loved and cared for and provided for and nurtured so that they could grow up to be healthy, to be strong, and to be ready for life ahead of them. And both parents play an important role in the life of a child. Both are essential to a well-rounded child. But especially in the early stages of life, the relationship between a mother and a child is amazingly important. In the sermon today, we want to look at how God created us and how, as part of that creation, there are special things that go on with a mother and a child. So we are fearfully and wonderfully made. And so we're going to look at this subject and think about brains, babies, and moms. Brains, babies, and moms. And I'd like to begin by looking at Psalm 139, verses 13 through 16. Psalm 139, verses 13 through 16. And this is part one, so there will be a part two to this, because there is more to it, and I think it's quite encouraging and amazing to look at. Psalm 139, verse 13. For you formed my inward parts, you covered me in my mother's womb. God is aware of a child in the mother's womb. God is aware of that baby in there, and they are very precious to him, just as they are precious to us. Verse 14 says, I will praise you, for I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Marvelous are your works, and that my soul knows very well. We are fearfully and wonderfully made. And when you begin to contemplate what a human body is like, the various functions that it has, to examine and think about an ear or an eye or the various senses we have, all of these things are amazing just to contemplate on their own. But the fact that they've all come together to form a human being, and they all work in conjunction, is truly amazing, an amazing thing. Verse 15 says, my frame was not hidden from you when I was made in secret and skillfully wrought in the lowest parts of the earth. Your eyes saw my substance being yet unformed, and in your book they all were written, the days fashioned for me when as yet there were none of them. God was aware of them. God had a purpose for human beings, and in this particular case, the individual that's speaking, and he has a very important purpose for you and me. So let's take a look at how we're fearfully and wonderfully made and think about brains and babies and moms. You may not have thought about it in these terms, but I think you'll find it interesting. A reality that we have to face in life is that people have challenges in developing and maintaining relationships. People have difficulties in their relationships. And in light of this, and it has been discovered that our neural systems, or our brain and those things that depend on our brains, and are responsible for emotion and intellect. And from this discovery, scientists have sought to understand how and why people love. How is it that they love, and why do they love? Psychiatrists and psychologists have observed in working with their clients that the world is full of men and women who encounter difficulty in loving and in being loved. And in working with their patients, they've sought to learn how these people have come to these difficulties. How is it that they have these difficulties, and how do you resolve it? These people that, where I got my information, these people had grown up being taught lots of Freudian ideas, Freud being the founder of psychology. So they grew up with all of his ideas, but they've come to see that his ideas, for the most part, are bogus. Freud still influences our world with his psychological ideas, but most of what he came up with has been found to be fraudulent. So Freud was a fraud, if I can say that. So anyway, they're his own ideas versus reality. So what they looked at is the various models that were given to them to try to help people with their relationship problems didn't work, because they weren't based on reality. So they began looking for other ideas that might lend themselves to their use in serving other people. And what they've sought to find out is how do we help people to love one another? How is that possible? And if that's not the secret to life, then what is? And the interesting thing is, these people are trying to figure out how to help people learn to love one another, but these people aren't Christians where I got my information. They are evolutionists. They believe in evolution. But, you know, I'm looking at it and I'm thinking, yes, you conclude this evolved, but I conclude God put this in us. That's how God made us. And I think that helps us, and that's a crucial thing to remember. Let's go to Malachi chapter 4. Malachi chapter 4. And let's look at verses 4 through 6. And this is something that's important, and it tells you how important it is to God that people would learn to have the right relationships. Malachi chapter 4, verses 4 through 6 says, "Remember the law of Moses, my servant, which I commanded him in Horeb for all Israel with the statutes and judgments. Behold, I will send you Elijah, the prophet, before the coming of the great and dreadful day of the Lord. And he will turn the hearts of the fathers to the children, and the hearts of the children to their fathers, lest I come and strike the earth with a curse." You see, the relationships between human beings are based upon the law of God. Applying the law of God should enhance your relationships, improve your relationships, show you how to have the relationship. And when you move away from the law of God, your ability to have relationships is diminished. And so what is the role that the church plays, and that this figure that's going to fulfill the role of Elijah is to turn the hearts of the fathers to the children, and the hearts of the children to the fathers to their children, and mothers and to their children, and children to their mothers, and build these right relationships? Because, you know, if we don't have these right relationships, then the earth will be smitten with a curse. And we see the lack of relationship, and we see the curses in our society every day, don't we? We see our curses every day. So what can we learn about the human mind and relationships? Could you give me my Bible? I think I left it there. And we'll need this. Not yet, but we will. So I can ask for it later, or I can ask for it now. So anyway, the human brain. Now you may be thinking, oh man, what's this about? If you look at the human brain, it's divided into three different aspects. There's the outside, which is all the part there close to the skull, is called the neocortex. The middle part of the brain is called the limbic region of the brain. And the part that's hooked to your spine and is an extension of the spine is called the reptilian brain. Okay, so there are three parts to the brain, and God made them so they all work together. Okay, they all work together. I mean, the reptilian brain isn't operating independently. The limbic brain isn't operating independently. They're all working together. Now, the reptilian brain, the reason that they've named it that is because of what it does, and because it seems to be similar to the way reptiles are. Well, just because there's a similarity of design does not mean that we evolved. What it means is God said, that's a good design, and I'm going to use it in people. And that's what he did. So the reptilian brain is, if you look at a reptile, for instance, we have an alligator here. Okay? So if you look at that alligator, there's nothing, when you look it in the eye, there's nothing going on there, okay? When a reptile looks at you, the only, lizards, snakes, reptiles, the only thing they see is either food or a threat. That's all they see. Reptiles have they have offspring, but they don't have a relationship with them. Basically, they have the offspring. They sit on the eggs. Once the eggs hatch, adios, and they either walk or slither away. And the reptilian brain allows for them to be able to, you know, like a frog to be able to zap a dragonfly as it's flitting along. It allows them to do that, and it allows them to function at a certain level. And in our case, the reptilian brain is that brain that if you take it away, the body will die. Okay, the reptilian part of your brain has to be functioning, and if it's not, it's over for you because it controls your heart rate, your breathing, and all of those kind of basic functions. All right. So if you're lobotomized, you know, you've heard of lobotomies. Well, what they basically do in doing a lobotomy is they stop, your neocortex is marginally functioning and your limbic system is not functioning, and all you're doing is breathing. You know, you're able to function at a certain level, but there's nothing much going on there in your life. The limbic brain was given to us by God so that we would not approach our children indifferently as reptiles do. But we would begin building a relationship with them from birth. We would love them and care for them and nurture them from birth. As I said, we don't just, as human beings, we don't just give birth and walk or slither away. God created us to nurse, to protect, to nurture our children from the minute that they come from the womb. And God created us to form close-knit, mutually nurturing social groups called families. And that's what God is seeking to do spiritually through the church. Having limbic brains allows us to do things like sing to our children, to play with them, and children to play with one another. In other words, God created us with a makeup which allows us to build and maintain relationships. Now, the third part of the brain that we're talking about is the neocortex. And the neocortex is a warehouse of secrets and unanswered questions because we don't fully understand it. However, we know that in the neocortex begins speaking, writing, planning, reasoning. They all originate there. So do the experiences of our senses, what we know as awareness, and our conscious motor control that we know as will. So we process what we see through the neocortex. So you see that the coffee is done, and so you plan, okay, I'm going to reach my hand out, I'm going to grab the coffee pot, I'm going to pour that into my cup, and I'm going to enjoy a cup of coffee. Okay, so you can think and plan and reason through your neocortex. The neocortex allows for abstract thought, of which language is the most useful. We're able to reason and plan through this portion of the brain. And God has created us with the capacity for all three portions of our brain to work and to interact and to allow us to function as beings made in His image. Okay? Now, emotions. Emotions. Are they important? Well, emotions are displayed, we feel exhilaration. You know, we can be exhilarated, full of life. We can long for something or somebody. We can grieve. We can feel a sense of loyalty. We can be furious. We can display love. And our emotions give our lives vibrancy and meaning. And emotions do more than color our sensory world. They are at the root of every act, more complicated than a reflex. Fascination, passion, and devotion draw us toward compelling people and situations. While fear and shame and guilt and disgust repel us from others. Emotions are humanity's motivator and ever-present influence. Science has discovered the deeper purpose of emotions. They found that the mechanisms of emotions allow two human beings to receive the contents of each other's minds. Our emotions allow us to do that. Emotion is the messenger of love. It's the vehicle that carries every signal from one heart to another. For human beings, feeling deeply is synonymous with the being alive. When you are emotionally dead, you know, if you reach a point where you are emotionally dead, you're going through life, but you have no feeling, no motivation, no purpose. And there are people, unfortunately, that reach that point. Interestingly, as you look at this baby, it has this beautiful smile. The question is, where did it come from? As scientists have looked at a child that's smiling, what they found is that if, let's say that a baby is born blind, and the baby can't talk, the baby can't walk, the baby can't do anything. But that baby, even though it's blind and it's never ever watched anybody smile, when that baby is interacting with its mother, and that mother is working with it and interacting with it pleasurably, the baby will smile. It's something that God created as a part of that child. It's something that's part of it before it's able to speak, to walk, or even to sit up. So that baby innately knows how to smile. Even though it's never seen its mother smile or anybody else smile. And it's one of the beautiful things that God has created as a part of all of us. Now, the limbic brain is the thing we're going to focus on more than anything. And you'll see as we go through here, you may think, is this a science class? There is some science here, but hopefully you can see how fearfully and wonderfully made we are. What we see, feel, hear, and smell is fed into the limbic brain. And so is data about body temperature, blood pressure, heart rate, digestive processes, and scores of other functions. Let's say that you go to the Department of Motor Vehicles, and you get in there, and you find out that there's a long line. What happens? Do you feel emotion? Maybe. Maybe you're trying, well, I'm going to be a Christian here, and I'm going to be calm. Okay, so you're calm, but there's a long line there, a lot of people trying to get their licenses renewed and get their tags and all that. So you're going to be calm, but you're there and you're waiting. And you can feel something's changing in your system. You have emotions, and it's affecting you. And it affects your heart rate. It could affect your blood pressure. It affects everything. And that's all part of your limbic system. The limbic brain stands at the convergence of these information streams and coordinates them and fine-tunes them to prime the body to deal with the outside world. And some of the changes are immediate. We can break out into a sweat. Our breathing can increase in frequency. Our heart rate can go up, which that's all coordinating the reptilian brain. Other bodily changes of limbic origin are longer lasting, like the endocrine system, which from which one example is adrenaline. As we're afraid, then adrenaline kicks in. That's part of your endocrine system to allow emotional states to affect the immune system and metabolism. And the neocortex receives limbic directives to basically bring about speech or planning or action. Now, as you look at human beings, we see these different expressions on the faces. And we can look at the expressions that you can see here pictured, and we can tell many times what's going on in that person. It's how God made us. The limbic brain orchestrates brain changes that serve a purely communicative role. Small muscles of the face contract in precise configurations. And you know what? Just as Mr. Evans talked about the speaking in tongues and all the different peoples that were there, you can go to any nation in the world and the expressions are the same. It doesn't matter where you go. You can go to Greece. You can go to Iceland. You can go to New Guinea. they all have the same types of expressions, and we would all recognize them. It's a universal language that, you know, if somebody's angry, we can tell whatever country they're from. We may not speak their language, but we can see their face and we can know what they're feeling. So the face is the only place in the body where muscles connect directly to the skin. The sole purpose of this is to allow for a flurry of expressive signals. So our muscles, you know, in our face connect directly to our skin. And we receive messages and we frown or we smile or whatever in order that we can express ourselves. Now, question is this. Among human beings, who are the masters at detecting facial expressions? Who are the masters at detecting facial expressions? They're called babies. Babies are the masters of detecting facial expressions. That's what they, from the time they're born, that's what they focus on. They focus on faces. They focus on faces. And researchers have found that babies are looking at expressions on the faces they fix on. And they're looking at the emotions being expressed on the faces around them. And one face in particular they're looking at, and that's mom's face. That's the face they want to see. That's the face they look to more than any other. Sorry, dads. They're not looking at your face as much. They love you, but they love mom, especially in those early stages. Now, an experiment was run, and what you see here is a big sheet of plexiglass, all right? And the plexiglass runs beyond where the baby's at, and they made it so that they put the plexiglass there and the baby, and there's a point where it looks like it's dropping off. And they did this in order to determine the importance that mom's emotional state has on a baby. So again, this is called the visual cliff experiment. So what they found was the baby will crawl to the edge of the cliff. And when he gets to the edge there, he sees a possible precipice. I could fall off. So the baby then looks at his mother. He looks at his mother and, based on her emotional state, decides what to do. If the mother radiates calm, then he keeps on crying. If she radiates, emotion, and then he detects that and he'll stop and he'll start crying many times. So he's looking to his mother as far as what to do, and he's looking at her facial expressions. Whether they realize it or not, mothers use the universal signals of emotion to communicate with their child long before they can speak. Babies don't just check with mom when there is uncertainty. They continuously monitor their mom's expression. If a mom's if a mother freezes her face, her baby becomes upset and begins to cry in short order. An infant can detect minute changes in emotional responsiveness. And they have a level of sophistication that's surprising for one who can't stand or walk. Human beings, especially babies, can sense the inner states and motives of others. They know when you're mad. They know when you're happy. They know how you feel. And this ability to be emotionally attuned is called limbic resonance. Limbic resonance is based in that area, that middle part of your brain. And when something resonates with you, it means it strikes home with you. So we're going to see an example of limbic resonance now. Okay? Now, dogs and mammals have a facet of them that is they have limbic brains, okay? So mammals have limbic brains to one extent or another. So what we want to see here is an example. This is just an example. So this is Steve, and Steve is limbically resonant. Notice he sees something. You probably won't remember anything, but you will remember this. She was asking me if I was filming it. I said, yes. So anyway, what you see there is an example of limbic resonance, okay? And what happens is dogs, like people, look at your face and they understand how you're feeling. Dogs are very good at picking up emotions in sore babies. And that's called limbic resonance. You may have never put a name on it, but we're all limbically resonant. When you see somebody you know, what do? Almost invariably, you will smile because you're happy to see them. When you see a friend, you see your wife or your husband or your children, you will smile. Now, you may not detect that, and you just take it for granted, but that's what we do. We are limbically resonant human beings. And as I said, limbic resonance is so commonplace that we just take it for granted, and when we're used to this and we like this, and if we're cut off from it, then we find its absence disturbing. And limbic resonance supplies the wordless harmony we see everywhere but take for granted, such as between a mother and an infant, a boy and his dog, lovers holding their hands. The silent reverberation between minds is so much a part of us that it functions smoothly and continuously without our notice. It's just part of our world. And it's the way God made us. We are limbically resonant human beings, and we need that. It's crucial to us. And interestingly, how crucial is it? These are called emoticons. Now, for those of the older generation, you probably don't text, and you probably don't email so much. But when you text or you email, nobody knows how you feel. Are you happy? Are you sad? Nobody knows. So emoticons have been created in order to express happiness and sadness and other things. And these are just crude ones that you can make by typing. But if you want to purchase them, you can get ones with smiley faces and sad faces and all that, which I'm not doing. I'm more old school. I'll write, and but you can see that it's an important part of communication. I can't see, you know, even when you're on the phone, you can't see faces. And also, something interesting, limbic states not only impact us as individuals, but also between a whole group of people. So here we are at church services. And limbic states can leap between minds. Feelings are contagious. The limbic activities of those around us draw our emotions into almost immediate congruence. That means they bring us all on the same page. We're all congruent. That's why a movie viewed in a theater of thrilled fans is electrifying. When it's the same movie at home, it's not as good. It's not the big screen or the speakers that make it better. It's the crowd that releases storytelling magic, the essential communal multiplied wonder. So, with that in mind, that's the way we are as human beings. Should this be surprising? Let's go to Hebrews chapter 10. Was our Creator aware of the fact that we are limbically resonant human beings? Hebrews chapter 10, beginning in verse 23. Hebrews chapter 10, verse 23. It says, "Let us hold fast the confession of our hope without wavering, for he who promised is faithful." So God is going to do his part, but we need to hold fast. And what's going to help us hold fast? Verse 24. "And let us consider one another in order to stir up love and good works." Does limbic resonance play a part of in this? Limbic resonance between fellow Christians, between brethren, does it impact us and help us to hold fast and beat fast and be encouraged in the faith? It certainly does. And look at what it says in verse 25. Not forsaking the assemblings of ourselves together, as is the manner of some, but exhorting one another, and so much more as you see the day approaching. He's telling us, you know what? You need each other. You need that reinforcement, that limbic resonance to take place with regularity by getting together as the people of God, and that's what helps you to hold fast. It helps you to endure. It helps you to be encouraged in the faith. And it's all part of how God created us. And sometimes we don't think so much about it, but you can see and think about it as you go about your everyday life. Think about, am I limbically resonant? Am I experiencing this as I deal with other people, as I go through my life? Human bonding. Now, we see the ducks following the dog. And that's called, an experiment was done, and they found out, and the label that was put on the ducks or the geese or whatever following something that they find early in their lives, and they follow it just like they would their mother. That's called imprinting. And the question is, do children do the same? Do children, is there imprinting between children and their parents? Well, unwittingly, an emperor by the name of Frederick II, Frederick the Great, the Holy Roman Emperor, he unwittingly conducted the first study of human bonding. And he wanted to determine what language was inborn in human beings. Back in his time, they felt that language was inborn. It was just part of you. You were born with it. And eventually it manifested itself magically. And so he wanted to find out, well, what was the original language that was inborn in individuals? Well, he thought it would probably be Hebrew. Okay? You know, the Bible was still important back then. It would probably be Hebrew or Greek. So what they did is they felt that by running this experiment, they would be able to determine that. So they had these children, and they were going to be cared for by foster mothers and nurses. And the foster mothers and nurses were to suckle, they were to bathe and wash the children, but they were not to speak to them. They were not to speak to them. And what happened? Every one of the children died. Every one of the children died. They were fed, they were bathed, they were washed, but nobody talked to them, and they all died. The conclusion, in their words, was children cannot live without clapping of hands and gestures and gladness of countenance and blandishments. In other words, there has to be human interaction. There has to be language. There has to be touching. There has to be all of those things that are crucial to humanity. In the 1940s, this experiment was repeated. A fellow by the name of René Spitz described the fate of orphan children who, in deference to the newly validated germ theory of disease, were fed, they were clothed, they were kept warm, they were kept clean, but they were not played with. Because the idea was, we want these children to grow up with the best of everything and to be healthy. And we know that germs are transferred from one person to another, so we'll do a minimal amount of touching them. So they were not played with. They were not handled or held. Human contact, it was thought, would expose them to sickness. So what do you think the result was? The physical needs were met, but the children became withdrawn, sickly. They lost weight, and a great many died. And the conclusion is that a lack of human interaction is fatal to infants. It's fatal to infants. So humans bond. And talking, and touching, and laughing. All of that is crucial to human bonding. Another theory is attachment theory. And this theory says that babies attach to their mothers. And that attachment is an inborn need. A baby has few motor skills, so when mother strays, how does he keep her near? He cries. He cries. And he figures out pretty fast that crying keeps mom, normal mothers, near. As the child develops muscular coordination, attachment behaviors become more elaborate and involve reaching, grasping, beckoning, crawling, clamoring to bring mother close. You know, you've all seen the baby that's crawling on the crawling and crying and crawling toward mom. Isn't that what they're doing? They're looking for mom. Certain conditions elicit forceful expressions of a child's desire to be at a parent's side. For instance, if they're in an unfamiliar place, people, they're around unfamiliar people or things. When they're fearful or there's pain or there's cold or there's illness or there's separations. And we've all seen, you know, every one of us has experienced, we've either seen it with our children or other children, that the child comes in with the parents and they don't know you and they don't know where they're at and what are they doing? Where are they at? They're holding on to their parents' leg. Have you ever seen that? Probably all of us. They're sticking pretty close. And then you're there talking to them, what's interesting is you'll see the child hugging pretty close to them, and then the child will become more comfortable and they'll begin to venture out, but they'll always go back, and they'll either at least look back or they'll go back. And they have that mother or the parents as a haven for them. And you know, we all need support. Have you ever gone into a situation in which you're somewhat fearful? Is it easier to take somebody with you? Oh, yeah. Come on, man, I need some support. Isn't that how we are? So, we're that way as little children, but we're also that way as adults. People, and interestingly, you see the picture here, people hug each other on departures and arrivals, an act that's so familiar we might think it nothing more than a custom. But this style of embrace contains self-evidence of attachment. An imposed separation or the threat of one reflexively makes people want to reestablish skin contact. You know, we hug each other when we see each other. Now, are the first years important to the development of a person? Are the early years important to them? Notice that let's go to Matthew chapter 18. Matthew chapter 18. Matthew chapter 18. And it tells us here something that relates to this. It says, "Assuredly I say to you, unless you are converted and become as little children, you will by no means enter the kingdom of God." So he's talking about little children in Matthew 18, verse 3. And verse 4 says, "Therefore, whoever humbles himself as this little child is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven. And whoever receives one little child like this in my name receives me." And then he goes on to talk about if you do damage to one of these little children in these early pliant years, it's a very serious thing in God's sight. As you think about these early pliant years, there was an experiment done in which mothers and their newborn infants were studied. And this study found that the kind of mother a child has predicts a child's emotional traits as they mature. In the process of the study, the group was divided into three categories based upon how the children were mothered. They divided them into three groups. The first group was mothers who were consistently attentive and responsive and tender to their infants, and they tended to raise a secure child who used his mother as a safe haven from which to explore the world. Upset and fussy when she left him, and reassured and joyful when she came back. And that's normal. And then there was the second group, and they divided them based upon how they approached their children. A second group were the cold, resentful, rigid mothers, and they produced insecure, avoidant children who displayed indifference to their mother's departures. You're going? Okay. And often pointedly ignored the mother on her return. They would turn, they found that sometimes, oftentimes the child would turn its back on its mother and crawl over to a toy. The third group were mothers who were distracted and erratic in their attentions. And what they helped to bring about were insecure, ambivalent toddlers, clutching at their mothers when the two were together and dissolving into wails and shrieks when the two separated. So you've got the attentive, you've got the ones that don't seem to care too much, and you've got those that are kind of spastic. They're both ways. So what happens as they grow up? What happens as they grow up? Does a mother's parenting skills impact the children as they mature? Well, they found out that babies of the responsive mothers developed into grade schoolers who were happy, socially competent, resilient, persistent, likable, and empathetic with others. Had more friends, were relaxed about intimacy, solved problems on their own when they could, and sought help when they needed it. Infants raised by mothers, by cold mothers, grew up to be distant, difficult to reach kids who were hostile to authority, shunned togetherness, and would ask for comfort, particularly would not ask for comfort, particularly when hurt. They often had a mean streak and seemed to take pleasure in provoking and upsetting other kids. The offspring of the unpredictable mothers metamorphed into children who were socially inept, timid, hypersensitive, and lacking in confidence. Hungry for attention and easily frustrated, they frequently asked for assistance with simple tasks that they should have been able to do. But they lack the confidence to do it, and they need the attention. So, what can we conclude about being attached and being secure? Attachment security continues to be a powerful predictor of life success. Securely attached children have a considerable edge in self-esteem and popularity as high school students, while the insecurely attached are proving excessively susceptible to the sad ensnarements of adolescence, delinquency, drugs, pregnancy, AIDS. The bottom line, what a mother does matters. What a mother does matters. Mothers shape their children in long-lasting and measurable ways, bestowing upon them some of the emotional attributes that they will possess and rely on to their benefit or detriment. The securely attached children were not necessarily the infants who were taken up into their mother's arms most frequently or held the longest. But when the baby needed hugging, they were hugged. When the baby needed held, they held. And when the baby said, okay, I've had enough, they would put them down. And when the child was hungry, the mother knew it and fed him. When tired, the mother felt it and kept him down for a nap. And when a mother sensed the baby needed to move on, she let it. So what about separations? What happens when they've separated? We've probably all seen this picture. You know, when you're leaving and, maybe it happened when you sent your child to school. Some kids, you know, they're on the bus at the window and the bus is pulling away and they're crying and you're as a parent feeling I'm just such a derelict for letting them go. My kids didn't. They got on the bus and, yeah, all right, we'll see you later, you know. So anyway, my kids, there was none of that. It didn't take them weeks to adjust. They were, man, I'm looking forward to it. I think, you know, they basically said, well, why don't you go home because I'm okay, you know. So anyway, it is interesting how kids are. But when we're separated, we tend to protest. That's a part of our limbic architecture. When the attachment is ruptured, then we tend to protest. And what do I mean by that? You can see in the picture that's illustrative of it. But anyone who has been jilted in an infatuation has experienced the protest phase firsthand. So you don't have to confess that you've gone through this. But if you've been basically gotten okay, it's over, we're not going to be boyfriend and girlfriend anymore, and you're on the brink of despondency, thoughts begin to go through your mind, the inescapable inner restlessness, the powerful urge to contact the person just to talk. Mistaken glimpses of the lost figure everywhere, a seething combination of overly vigilant scanning and blind hope. They're all part of protest. The drive to reestablish contact is sufficiently formidable that people often can't resist it. I shouldn't call them, but I'm going to anyway. I'm going to leave that 45th message on their answering machine, you know. Even when they understand the other person doesn't want anything to do with them, they continue that process. Now, when separation continues on, things can spiral downward emotionally, and that's when despair sets in. Anyone who has grieved a death has known despair from the inside. The leaden inertia of the body, that is, the inability to seemingly move. The indifference to everything but loss, that's all you can think about. The aversion to food, you're just not hungry. The urge to closet oneself away, you don't want to see anybody, be around anybody. The inability to sleep, the relentless grayness of the world. And grief is normal. But when we go through something like that and we are grieving, we get somewhat of an experience of what major depression is like. Prolonged separation affects more than feelings. Losing relationships can cause illness. A mother continually adjusts her infant's physiology. One can interrupt a single thread of her influence and disrupt the corresponding physiology of her baby. That's the whole functioning of the baby. And when the mother is absent, an infant loses all his organizing channels at once. Like a marionette with its strings cut, his physiology collapses into a huddled heap of despair. You know, he's just despondent. My dog was despondent today, being limbically resonant. He knew we were leaving. So what's he doing? He goes and lays on the couch, sad eyes, and knowing we're leaving. And he does it every week. He knows we're leaving. He knows we're getting dressed, we're doing all this, and he realizes they're not taking me. So, and that's the way babies are. Okay, the mom leaves the baby, and the baby's just, just wiped out. And the fact is, this happens not only with babies, but with older children. It takes longer for that to kick in, and it even happens with adults. And as we look at human beings, the question are we closed loop or are we open loop? Closed loops basically gives you the idea that you're self-sustaining. You don't need anybody. You, as a human being, are an island. You don't need anybody. Okay? So are we closed loop or are we open loop? The fact is, in some functions of our body and mind, we are closed loop. But for the most part, we're open looped individuals. In other words, we rely on each other. We depend on each other. And our health, mental and physical health, depends on one another. We are impacted by those we are close to. We already looked at the example of the babies that were not touched and didn't interact and what happened to them. Babies, as they're born, they basically outsource the governance of their bodies, their whole system, to their parents. And as they get older, they take over more of that. But when they're very young, they're dependent upon their parents. And their early exposure to the external order that parents provide teaches babies how to manage some of their rhythms on their own. And the thing is, even with the best parenting, as a baby matures, he reclaims the processes and performs them himself apart from his parents. But no child transitions to a fully self-tuning adult. We all remain social animals, and we continue to require others to help us stabilize. We can't stabilize on our own. We just can't do it. And this fact is tough for us as individuals to believe. And our society says we're all individuals. We don't need anybody. That's not true. Total self-sufficiency turns out to be a daydream whose bubble is burst by the sharp edge of the limbic brain. Stability means finding people who regulate you well and staying near them. That's why God brought us together as the church. That's why He created families. So, what conclusions can we reach at this point? God established husbands and wives as the foundation of a loving family. And children depend on parents, especially mom, in the formative years. And God established the church in order to provide a loving relationship among His spiritual family. In essence, the church is to be our mother. And the most important conclusion here, I don't know why that came up that way, but anyway, the most important conclusion is this: we are fearfully and wonderfully made by our God. So hopefully that gives you a little bit of insight into mothers and brains and babies and mothers. And there are some other aspects of that that I would like to cover here. That's why it's called Part 1. And we'll take a look at that here in the future. So hopefully you found that positive and helpful and encouraging, that God has made us wonderfully. So please remember to sign the cards that are back on the information table so that we can get those sent out to those who are not going to be able to join us for Pentecost. So hopefully that. So now we have one last song and close service.